A stream of statements from leading aid organization officials reflects how dire the situation has become, including a warning from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres that Yemen is now in imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen for decades. We've been warning since July that Yemen is on the brink of a catastrophic food security crisis. If the Saudi invasion doesn't end now, we are nearing an irreversible situation and risk losing an entire generation of Yemen's young children, said Lisa Grand last month, the humanitarian coordinator for Yemen. The data we are releasing today confirms that acute malnutrition among children is hitting the highest levels we have seen since the war started, she added. The Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, raised the alarm about millions of Yemenis risking falling into worsening levels of hunger by mid-2021. The United Nations World Food Program, WFP, also described the crisis in Yemen as the world's worst. The WFP said in a tweet that millions are trapped in a cycle of conflict and hunger. Everyday life in Yemen gets harder for millions as the window to prevent famine narrows. We must act now. Although a mass famine event may be unlikely in the immediate future, officials in Taiz warn that many areas could soon start to see death from famine. Many children already have signs of severe acute malnutrition, the most dire stage of hunger where legs and feet begin to swell. We all sleep hungry. There is not enough food even for our children, said Omar Abdo. Saudi Arabia has a plan to destroy the national currency in order to intentionally accelerate famine. The exchange rate divergence between Sana'a and coalition-controlled Aden is indeed stark, with the Yemeni rial worth 35% less in Aden than it is in Sana'a. Umar was one of the thousand of Yemenis that took the streets in Taiz and other areas recently in a mass protest against the continuing deterioration of the economic situation, denouncing the Saudi-led coalition states and demanding they leave the country as soon as possible. Demonstrators accused the invading coalition countries and ousted Yemeni President Abdrabo Mansour Hadi of practicing a policy of starvation to achieve their personal objectives. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia and UAE regimes with phrases like, "Our revolution is a hungry revolution. Take your aid and leave our country. Leave our oil. Take your donations and leave us our ports. And take your trust fund and leave us our wealth." According to local economists who spoke to Mint Press News, the reasons behind the collapse of Yemen's economy and its currency are many and varied, but the monetary policy that has been taken by Saudi Arabia regime is one of the key drivers of the Yemeni rial devaluation. Local authorities supported by Saudi Arabian regime have regularly printed new banknotes in order to meet expenses compounded by the purchase of foreign currencies flowing into markets by foreign organizations. By the end of 2019, the total rial liquidity in circulation in Yemen was more than 3 trillion, according to a source in the Aden-based central bank. As of the beginning of 2020, the bank has printed around 300 billion rials in order to address the budget deficit. The government of ousted President Hadi has largely relied on the central bank's overdraft financing instrument to cover his spending abroad, including rent, travel, and entertainment. Recently, Saudi Arabia regime proxies in southern Yemen have been selling large quantities of newly printed banknotes in order to purchase foreign currency from the market and replenish their own foreign currency holdings. This has increased downward pressure on the riyal's value and helped drive inflation. Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on countries to provide financial assistance to resolve the severe economic crisis in Yemen, saying in a statement issued via his spokesperson Stephen Dujarric on the second anniversary of a Stockholm Agreement, a call on all member states to help address the severe economic crisis in Yemen. Ome Abdo has a gloomy future. She has no faith in the UN or the Saudi regime proxies in the south, who she described as drenched in treason. Nonetheless, she places hope in God and in her fellow Yemenis that her country will be freed. Where else on earth can you find a nation that has gone through what has happened in Yemen, occupied by foreigners, destroyed with famine and epidemics, and yet somehow we still managed to survive?
On the news line.
As the world advances in its technological capabilities, so too then does the way in which various countries across the world need to protect its assets, particularly when it comes to data, information, and national security through the medium of computer-based hosts. The US has recently stated that it's become victim to yet another highly sophisticated cyber attack on its infrastructure, in particular with the attack aimed at multiple ministries across the US government. And more worryingly for the US, it seems that although discovered, the attack is still ongoing. Some of the departments have come out and announced that their systems have been breached at the Departments of Energy, the Treasury, and the Department of Commerce. At this stage, it's not clear which other departments have been hacked into, although there are reports that the National Nuclear Security Administration, which maintains the country's nuclear stockpile, has also been broken into. The US authorities have yet to admit that other more sensitive departments have also been targeted. The hacking appears to have started in March, targeting the Texas-based network security firm SolarWinds via their so-called Orion software, which was incidentally used by a host of US federal agencies and departments. It's unknown at this point as to just how serious the breaches have been, how much information has been obtained by the hackers, or what kind of information has been taken. But what is known is that some 18,000 people have uploaded the SolarWinds Orion update, loaded with the software, allowing the hackers in via the back door. A highly embarrassing situation for the US government. So does this incident suggest that the US is lagging behind in their capability when it comes to preventing such hacks? For a start, the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, has suffered a huge blow to their reputation, raising the speculation as to whether the US are becoming weaker or whether the hackers are simply getting smarter.
I think it's the latter. I think the hacking abilities have improved. And there's been a proliferation of a lot of private hacking entities, companies, corporations, etc., which have proved quite adept when it comes to penetrating the most tightly guarded software facilities.
The priority for the US will now involve securing their cyberspace infrastructure and making sure that the damage done does not cost them too dearly. With more and more states becoming ever more aware and capable when it comes to cyber warfare, the US now have to contemplate who the authors of the cyber attack were and why they targeted the US in the way they did. After all, the US have a host of adversaries around the world. In typical fashion, the Americans have already pointed their fingers towards Moscow as the perpetrators of the attack, claiming that the technology can only have come from a sophisticated source, backed by a state. However, the Russians have nonsensed the US claims, stating they do not participate in such acts. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has been quoted as stating that the US should not put the blame of their own failures on Russia, claiming that Russia will not stand by and be blamed for anything and everything the US decides it needs a scapegoat for. With Russia being blamed, then, could the future of warfare between sovereign states turn to cyber-based attacks, and hence see an elevation in frequency and sophistication in the near future?
Yeah, this is a big problem. I mean, attribution is very difficult. It's very difficult to figure out who was behind these attacks. And that's a big problem, because if there's a major disruption, a major attack in the U.S., and say, you know, power grids go out or emergency services are cut off or whatever, there'll be enormous pressure to retaliate. And therefore, the U.S. could respond in kind to Russia, only to discover months later that it really wasn't Russia at all.
With the White House and Donald Trump remaining eerily silent so far, the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden has come forward, stating that significant funds will be generated during his presidency to disrupt and deter adversaries in targeting the U.S. through cyber attacks. With cyber warfare fast becoming the new norm in global security issues, it seems that across the world, states need to both prepare themselves for cyber attacks and use the technique to secure an advantage over others, as fifth-generation warfare fast becomes a new tool of the state. But more worryingly for all is the notion that individuals and lone actors are also capable, and in fact more dangerous, when it comes to security breaches in national security through the medium of cyber attacks. So next time you're on your computer, be careful. You have been warned.
The issue of human rights once again caused controversy and deep divisions at the United Nations General Assembly this week. The Assembly passed a resolution on the human rights situation in Iran on Wednesday. The document was critical of the use of death penalty and prison conditions, among other alleged rights violations in Iran. The resolution was proposed by the Canadian government and supported by the United States and mostly its regional and Western allies. The UN General Assembly has 193 members, but the resolution against Iran was passed with 82 votes in favor. That's significantly less than half of the number of member states. The Iranian government was quick to condemn the move, saying an anti-Iran bloc used the General Assembly on Wednesday as a tool to impose pressure on Iran. Tehran argues that the resolution has exposed sheer hypocrisy regarding human rights, because many of the proponents of the anti-Iran move have either notorious records of human rights violations or choose to remain silent on such violations in some parts of the world. Tehran said the states behind the resolution are under the influence of American bullying. The Iranian government says those states have turned a blind eye to U.S. economic terrorism against the Iranians at the time of a worsening pandemic, that are acting as Washington's accomplices instead of condemning its illegal and inhumane sanctions that have hurt ordinary Iranians. This week, the United States voted against, while European states and Canada abstained from voting on an important Russia-drafted document. The initiative was titled Combating Glorification of Nazism, Neo-Nazism, and Other Practices that Contribute to Fueling Contemporary Forms of Racism, Racial Discrimination, Xenophobia, and Related Intolerance. The Russian-drafted resolution was passed with 130 votes in favor, despite the campaign by the U.S. and its allies. The Russian initiative is aimed at condemning and combating some of the most notorious forms of violation of human rights in the world, like Nazism and racism. So why did the U.S. and its allies choose to stand against or be different towards the resolution? Was it because the text was drafted by Russia, which is a rival in the world stage? Critics say what happened this week at the UN General Assembly further exposed double standards adopted by the U.S. and its allies regarding human rights around the world.
Ultimately, anything they do in the name of human rights always is underpinned with their own economic interests. And they don't make any bones about this. They will drop the principles of human rights when it comes to anything which threatens their economic interests. So this is a highly dubious moral position to take, given that you're finding these nations squawking the loudest about the supposed human rights violations in other nations.
Meanwhile, some of the states that are very loud in lecturing others at the UN are themselves known violators of human rights at home. An instance is Canada, which is widely criticized for its violations of the rights of its indigenous population and widespread discrimination against them. Meanwhile, Persian Gulf Arab allies of the United States are also among the states that join US-led campaigns against other countries over human rights. The Arab countries like Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates are ranked among the world's worst rights violators. Observers believe this trend needs to change if the US and its allies really care about human rights around the world. India has been the scene of mass anti-government protests since September. This after the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi introduced a reform bill, which was later passed into law, seeking to deregulate India's agricultural sector by setting a minimum support price known as MSP and allowing farmers to sell their crops to private buyers. Protesters, however, have a different understanding of the law. They accused the government of Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party of aiming to benefit big corporations, leaving farmers at the mercy of a free market while they can sell crops at higher prices if the demand is there. They have called on all farmers to hold sit-in protests outside district offices throughout the country.
I think they wonder if the farmers say that they need minimum guarantee of income. Obviously, they have a point. That's my opinion. That they have a point in saying that we want minimum guarantee of income, otherwise we will suffocate and we will die.
On Monday, protest leaders and community organizers called for demonstrations to be held in all districts across the entire nation. They also intensified their agitation by calling on demonstrators to start a day-long hunger strike. In many of such events, protests have turned violent with police using military tactics, including water cannons and tear gas, against frustrated protesters to disperse them. Some were also beaten with batons. The law allows farmers to sell their produce outside government-controlled agricultural markets, which ensures prices wouldn't get too high. Modi says this will give farmers a chance to decide their own prices and sell directly to private businesses like grocery chains, which ultimately cut the traders and middlemen.
The amount of money that the farmers are going to lose is unbelievable, because if they allow these, what we call, free market enterprises to get into this place and get rid of the farmers, small industry farmers.
Yet several rounds of negotiations between the government and protest leaders have had no tangible result. The farmers want authorities to completely repeal the law. Even a written proposal to the farmers' union, which laid out a series of amendments, including written assurances over MSP, has not stopped farmers from calling off their protests. Farmers say the amendments are just part of cosmetic changes to the law, and it does not really change its character. They say the only way left for the farmers is to continue their protests until their demands are met. Agriculture contributes more than 15% of India's GDP, making it the largest employment source and a significant piece of its overall socio-economic development. It has employed 49% of its total workforce, that accounts for more than half of the country's working population. According to Hindustan Times, from 2018 to 2019, the average Indian farmer earned 10,329 rupees, which is about $140 per month. Of more than 263 million workers, many solely rely on farming to put food on their table and roof over their head. Based on figures released by India's Ministry of Commerce and Industry, the country is the world's largest producer, consumer, and exporter of spices, producing nearly 70% of the world's spices. It is also the world's largest milk producer and the second largest rice and wheat producer after China.
Modi government doesn't realize that it's an agricultural economy that basically they have. But since they have progressed so much, they think that they are able to, what you call, get rid of those laws and give the industry, the so-called free market. In that doesn't work in case of this sort of situation as it is. The farmers say they want minimum guarantees. The Modi government is not able, so far, is unwilling to give them those tools.
The crisis in the agricultural sector in India is nothing new, as the country has been suffering for decades. Things changed significantly in the 1960s when India went through the Green Revolution under then Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, who implemented the growth of high-yielding wheat and rice crops to address famine in the country. The revolution marked the beginning of industrializing the agricultural sector and introduced new methods of fertilization and the use of pesticides, which negatively affected many farmers. Now with the new law, nothing can be guaranteed except growing inequalities and disparity among the Indian population. The crisis will also leave one of the world's largest economies in tatters.
The United States are quick to condemn other nations around the world on a whole host of issues, from political alignment to economic choices, yet it's on human rights that the US is the most hypocritical of them all, as federal inmates are being executed in a final purge prior to Trump's imminent departure. When Trump came to power, and in fact during both his election campaigns, he claimed that he would be a champion of the justice system, famously stating to Hillary Clinton during one televised debate that he would get her arrested. Yet with time ticking away before Trump hands over the reins to Joe Biden, the incumbent president appears to have gone on a federal killing spree, executing more prisoners since he's been in power than all other state executions combined, making him responsible for more executions than any other modern president. In 2020 alone, state-ordered executions totaled 7 across all 50 states of the US, yet Trump's federal executions have totaled 10, with 3 more inmates on death row due to be terminated prior to January the 21st, something that Trump will likely see out as the deadline approaches, potentially bringing the total to 13, almost double the amount of state executions. The decision by Trump to go on a final execution spree breaks with the norm, as traditionally, death row inmates are usually exempt from execution during a presidential transition period, allowing the incoming to consider clemency should the terms and conditions apply.
I think the number that we've seen from the Trump administration is astronomical compared to what we've seen from previous administrations combined. And so, especially by adding on some on top of what was already scheduled, I think it's clear that they're trying to rush the execution process.
But it seems that Trump is merely following the age-old US tradition of using the death penalty, as since colonial times, the US has executed over 15,000 people. Many of them had been later found to be not guilty due to technological advances, criminal investigations improving, and public opposition to the death penalty increasing. Naturally, the timing of the latest execution has raised the question as to whether this is genuinely a cause for justice, or is this simply Donald Trump playing God for one last time, showing the US and the rest of the world just what kind of man he really is. Trump has shown he's not shy when it comes to stirring racial hatred in the US. His mishandling of the Black Lives Matter movement was one of the key reasons he lost the presidential election to Joe Biden, leaving behind a country deeply divided along a racial line in the process. The sentiment is reflected in the US criminal justice system, especially on death row, as since 1976, only 21 white defendants have been executed for crimes against black people, yet 297 black suspects have been executed in the US for crimes on white people, clearly showing the system is racist to the core. Trump's also demonstrated a history of racist views, labeling the Black Lives Matter movement as a destructive entity, not designed to bring equality and justice to black people, but to bring the entire US infrastructure to a halt, something that's baffling to hear.
The stated goal of BLM organization people is to achieve the destruction of the nuclear family, abolish the police, abolish prisons, abolish border security, abolish capitalism, and abolish school choice. That's what their stated goals are. This is not the agenda of the black community. This is the agenda of an extreme socialist, or worse, You know what the other word is. Yeah, Marxist, communist.
With Trump supporters clearly echoing the sentiments of the outgoing president, groups such as the Proud Boys and other far-right organizations are lapping up the attention and openly supporting a crackdown on black people, either through the use of police brutality or through the execution chamber, something that the US has a haunting history on when it comes to killing black people. Yet the situation may be about to change in the US, with President-elect Joe Biden stating that he is in fact against the death penalty, and should the conditions be met, he can end the act with a stroke of a pen. However, Biden, like many others before him, still has a lot to demonstrate that he can turn his words into actions.
Quote, "You won't be safe in Joe Biden's America." And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today.
What now remains to be seen is whether Trump's last stand will be to execute the three remaining federal prisoners prior to him leaving, and more importantly, whether the US now, and in the future, considers its own actions before criticizing others.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The ICC said that there was a reasonable basis to believe that between 2003 and 2009, British troops murdered at least 7 prisoners and tortured 54 others during the occupation of Iraq. It found there was a reasonable basis to believe that at least 7 captives were raped or sexually abused as detainees in Camp Breadbasket run by British Armed Forces. The stark contrast between ICC's findings and its actions are deeply troubling. It is essentially saying that we know you raped and murdered, but you are free to go because we believe you will police yourself. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Muazzam Beg Ryder. This article is published under the heading "Failure to Prosecute British War Crimes in Iraq Exposes ICC's Own Failings." Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Finds UK war crimes but will not take action. That was the news headlines following the International Criminal Court's publication of its detailed investigation into war crimes committed by British troops during the occupation of Iraq. The ICC's report is based on the findings of a preliminary inquiry to determine both whether there is a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes were committed and to assess whether the UK has itself investigated and sought to prosecute those accused of involvement. The ICC concluded that because the UK was not unwilling to investigate and prosecute its troops for committing war crimes in Iraq, the investigation was being closed. The truth, however, is that the British regime has gone to exceptional lengths to ensure that British troops accused of committing war crimes in Iraq are immune from prosecution. Out of the hundreds of cases pending against British troops, by June this year, only one such case remained open. In March, the British presented the Overseas Operation, that is, Service Personnel and Veterans Bill. The law will place a 5-year limit on criminal prosecutions against troops accused of war crimes and a 6-year limit on civil actions. Any cases outside of these periods will require the Attorney General's consent. There will also be a duty for the government to consider abandoning its commitment to the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR, ahead of military expeditions overseas. The new law will stop countless claims of war crimes against British troops who served as part of the military occupation of Iraq. The bill had its third reading in the Commons in November and is primed to becoming law in the new year. The aim of the proposed law is to protect British troops from what the government calls vexation litigation. The government often cites the case of Phil Shiner, the British lawyer who successfully exposed the role of British troops in the torture and murder of Musa, an Iraqi man who died in British custody in Basra in 2003. Shiner was struck off by the Solicitors Regulation Authority in 2017 after being found guilty of professional misconduct charges, including paying an Iraqi middleman to fine claimants to make allegations against British troops. Shiner had submitted thousands of claims against the British Army, so this was the opportunity the government, having previously denounced law firms involved in litigation against British troops as ambulance-chasing lawyers, was waiting for. In the same year, the government shut down its own investigation. The Iraq Historic Allegations Team, IHAT, which had been set up to investigate allegations of torture by British troops. None of the IHAT cases led to prosecutions. Despite denying the allegations of war crimes, the government reached out-of-court settlements with at least 326 claimants. It was, however, following on from Shiner's work, that the ICC picked up the baton where the IHAT had dropped it. According to a report, British IHAT detectives said they had seen evidence of war crimes carried out by British troops and alleged that Shiner's case was used to close down their investigation. The ICC said that there was a reasonable basis to believe that between 2003 and 2009, British troops murdered at least 7 prisoners and tortured 54 others. It found there was a reasonable basis to believe that at least 7 captives were raped or sexually abused as detainees in Camp Breadbasket run by British Armed Forces. The stark contrast between ICC's findings and its actions are deeply troubling. It is essentially saying that we know you raped and murdered, but you are free to go, because we believe you will police yourself. This is what one IHAT detective said. The Ministry of Defense had no intention of prosecuting any troop of whatever rank he was unless it was absolutely necessary, and they couldn't wriggle their way out of it. Around 120,000 British troops served in Iraq for 6 years. In light of all that has emerged with U.S. atrocities in Abu Ghraib and Camp Buka, and revelations of the atrocities and cover-ups unearthed by WikiLeaks, it is not inconceivable that British troops committed many war crimes or that the British regime would seek to cover them up. After all, these troops were part of and allied to the most powerful and organized military machine in the world. They were armed, trained, and motivated to fight, capture, interrogate, and kill in the name of Queen and country. Of course, it wasn't just Iraq. The brutality had begun in Afghanistan following the US-led invasion in 2001. An investigation this year found a deliberate policy of executioner-style killings was being carried out by British special forces against unarmed men. Reports also found that British troops planted drugs and guns on the bodies of unarmed Afghans they had killed. Once again, the government was left to investigate itself. Operation Northmoor was set up in 2014, but the investigation was closed down in 2017 after looking at 675 allegations of abuse, but without interviewing key witnesses. The investigation, Royal Military Police, that is RMP, found no evidence of criminal behavior by the armed forces in Afghanistan. In November, the Australian Defence Force, ADF, released findings from a four-year inquiry that found Australian troops serving in Afghanistan, fueled by bloodlust and competition killing, tortured and executed unarmed Afghan prisoners, and then covered up their crimes by planting guns. In the Australian case, 39 people were killed. Some of them were shot dead. Two children reportedly had their throats slit. The report includes the chilling account of one special forces operative and how ADF troops idolized British and American troops' atrocities. Whatever we do, though, I can tell you that Brits and the US are far, far worse. I watched our young guys stand by and hero worship what they were doing, salivating at how the U.S. were torturing people. Although at times it has backed ICC prosecutions of individuals, the Trump administration has shown its open hostility to the court by freezing ICC assets and placing prosecutor Fatou Bensouda and others on a travel ban. The ICC is also penalized by the U.S. for investigating the Israeli regime war crimes. Once again, it seems the ICC is quite willing to prosecute Africans, but far less able to prosecute the Western nations. It may be because Britain is, by the government's own account, one of the largest contributors to ICC coffers that this prosecution didn't go ahead. Or maybe that the ICC is just a paper tiger. Whatever the case, there is no escaping the connotations of this. The ICC could have set a very powerful and visible precedent in holding Britain to account. It could have given hope and a semblance of justice to those who have neither. Instead, the ICC is a laughingstock, and few will be able to take it seriously again.
Around the world with reporters.
In a rare case, the second in Yemen in the past 3 years, a pair of conjoined twins were born in a Sabaeen hospital in Yemeni capital Sana'a. The two children are in critical condition and need to be treated outside the country, which is impossible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a airport to the Yemenis.
This is a tragedy that children in Yemen suffer as a result of aggression, blockade, and the use of internationally prohibited weapons as well as malnutrition. In the case of the Siamese twins and congenital deformations, the biggest problem is that we cannot send them abroad to have surgery, so their lives are at risk.
The director of the Health Bureau called on the United Nations and the World Health Organization to send a plane to transport the two children or to send a medical team to conduct the surgery inside Yemen, where devastated and under-resourced health services cannot offer any help to these children.
I'm the father of the twins, and their condition is critical, and they need to receive medical care and surgery outside the country because the health situation in Yemen is collapsing and Sana'a Airport is still closed.
Infants suffer a difficult situation in Yemen, and the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemen health services have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war on the country in 2015.
With the fast approaching of the new year, the Sana'a Airport remains closed to sick children and women, causing the loss of many lives. The airport is open to United Nations airplanes only. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Local elections in Indian-administered Kashmir, held in 8 phases, have come to an end. The voting process has remained by and large peaceful amid stringent security measures. After the revocation of Kashmir's special status, regional political parties had refused to participate in the electoral process as a sign of protest against India's decision to strip Kashmir of its autonomous status. That resulted in the strengthening of the Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party in the Muslim majority region. However, this time, the regional parties formed an alliance to take part in the local elections. Compared to the past, a large number of people came forth to cast their ballots, and many of them told Press TV that their aim is to keep the BJP away from Kashmir's grassroots.
Since the BJP came to power in India, it started taking decisions against minorities. The BJP has taken Kashmir's autonomy, Kashmiris' jobs, and now they are eyeing land. They don't care about the people of Kashmir. We came to cast our votes against those people who only aim to destroy Kashmir's ethnicity in the name of mainstreaming Kashmir.
More and more people in Kashmir have developed skepticism on the overall electoral process after scores of video interviews of the District Development Council or DDC candidates started circulating on social media. A number of candidates have no idea what positions they are running for in the local administration, and even worse, some have no idea what DDC means.
In order for votes to be equally distributed, the Election Commission has accepted nominations from all sorts of people. There is no set prerequisite for candidates. I wonder who they are empowering. How can an uneducated person with no idea of economy, finance, and politics seek equal rights and development for me? Basically, they do not need educated people. They want stooges who will implement what the Indian government will decide for us without thinking about people's interests.
This is the first time that DDC elections are being held. Members of the DDC are expected to prepare and approve district plans and expenditure schemes, which will replace the district planning and development boards in all districts across the region. Earlier, district development boards looked after the planning, approval, or implementation of centrally sponsored schemes. The result of the 8-phase elections will be announced on December 22nd. Apparently, the elections in Kashmir have paved the way for other electoral processes in the volatile region. However, many say this ballot has made the people of Kashmir politically aware of the fact that New Delhi is trying to thrust such electoral processes in order to create an impression that normalcy has taken hold after it stripped Kashmir of its autonomy, actually without building trust and bridging the gaps. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Chinese military on Saturday said it had tailed and monitored a U.S. warship as it passed through the Taiwan Strait. The military said the move deliberately raises the temperature of the Taiwan issue. is that the move jeopardizes peace and stability in the strait. The Chinese military also accused the U.S. of using the Taiwan issue as a pawn for what it called selfish strategic purposes. The U.S. Navy, however, said its guided missile destroyer wasn't a routine mission in accordance with international law. China considers Taiwan as part of its own territory and is opposed to the increasing U.S. support for the island. Last week, the U.S. approved a new major arms sales to Taiwan in a deal worth $280 million. The package is the sixth this year and includes advanced military communications equipment. Washington says the sale aims to improve the security of Taiwan. But some analysts believe the U.S. seeks to push back against China.
The United States doesn't want to create a war over Taiwan, but is trying to push the envelope. It's trying to, without breaking the one-China policy, is selling more and more arms to Taiwan, as I said, as part of the pushback against China.
Tensions have been simmering between the U.S. and China over other issues as well, from trade to the coronavirus pandemic and political developments in Hong Kong. The U.S. has also prepared a so-called entity list that mainly hits key Chinese industries over what Washington calls ties to China's military. On Thursday, the Pentagon said U.S. warships would be more assertive in responding to what it described as violations of international law. It accused China of being the most pressing long-term strategic threat. In response, China said it seeks no conflict with the U.S. and wants mutual respect and cooperation leading to a win-win outcome.
We hope that the U.S. side will take a rational and objective view of China's development of its national defense and armed forces, work with China to focus on cooperation, manage differences, and bring the China-U.S. relationship back to the right track.
The souring ties between China and the U.S. come in the wake of President Donald Trump's America First policy. With the incoming U.S. President Joe Biden set to take office on January 20th, it remains to be seen how the currently toxic relationship between the world's two biggest economies will look like. Will the new U.S. president stick to Trump's policy tools and continue the frictions? Will he try to de-escalate the tensions? Or will he take a more aggressive anti-China approach?
Russian President Vladimir Putin held his annual press conference. This year it was held in a new format, video conferencing, because of pandemic.
The end of a year Q&A session is a rare chance to get President Putin to answer important issues and draw attention to the country's problems. It has long become one of the biggest media events in the country, broadcasted live on main news channels and radio stations in Russia for the whole duration.
Speaking about the new START arms control treaty between Washington and Moscow, Putin accused the U.S. of starting a new arms race. Putin reiterated his call urging Washington to extend the new START arms control treaty for 1 year.
Now there's a threat that strategic arms reduction treaty is terminated. This would mean that there are no more restrictions on the arms race. None at all. We have called and continue to call our Western partners to extend this treaty for at least a year. During this year, we would have substantive talks, as diplomats say, on what to do next and how to live on.
Putin said he believed U.S. President-elect Joe Biden is open to dialogue on the issue, but added Russia needs some reaction from the U.S.
That it is the last point that connects the Russian Federation with the United States on strategic issues, because all other treaties and agreements signed by Soviet Union, Russian Federation and the United States were dismissed, were destroyed by administration of Trump. Now we are entering a new period of development in American policy. That's why we hope that previous all agreements and treaties will be respected.
The new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, also known as START, is the last remaining agreement that maintains a nuclear balance between the two countries. Putin also said that the unfounded poisoning scenario of opposition politician Alexei Navalny was in fact part of the US-backed plot repeated by media to try to discredit the Russian leader. He stressed that Navalny was not important enough to be a target. Navalny, 44, was taken ill on a domestic flight on August 20. He was later transported to the German capital. German doctors, however, claimed Navalny had been poisoned with a substance from the group of cholinesterase inhibitors. Since then, Germany and other Western governments have been attacking Russia with accusations that it poisoned Navalny. Moscow has repeatedly and strongly rejected the allegation. Marina Kotanova, Moscow.
Before entering his latest and perhaps last round of negotiations with UK counterparts, the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, addressed the European Parliament early on Friday morning.
Nous sommes à un moment de vérité.
It is the moment of truth.
Il nous reste...
We have very little time remaining, just a few hours to work through these negotiations in a useful fashion if we want this agreement to enter into force on the 1st of January.
There are less than 2 weeks to go before Britain might crash out of the Brexit transition period without a crucial EU trade deal.
Shameful UK government strategy.
Some EU lawmakers are in no doubt as to which side is to blame for the deadlock.
The UK government is taking endless time to realise that some illusions of Brexit simply cannot be delivered.
Many legislators claim the UK faces financial ruin if Boris Johnson's government fails to reach an agreement with the EU.
Meanwhile, the Scottish National Party is waiting in the wings to call a second independence referendum that could very well see the breakup of the United Kingdom.
It has been pointed out that long delays can already be witnessed at EU-UK border crossings.
Dear British friends, is this what you voted for? Passport stamps and lorry queues? This moment is a victory for Europe.
But the European Union is in no position to gloat, it has been argued.
The real division isn't between the EU and the UK. It's between the haves and the have-nots, and we start dealing with that or there'll be a lot more Brexits to come.
Deal or no deal, business groups say the EU needs to pursue major structural reforms, especially in the context of Brexit.
There's a mismatch clearly, so we need better mobility. We need to be able to match the supply with the demand for workers across Europe, not just within member states.
Fishing rights remain the major sticking point in the negotiations. One EU lawmaker has reminded Boris Johnson that his closest ally will soon be history. The COVID-19 pandemic is still here, and so he should choose his next moves carefully. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Parliament of Catalonia Friday approved an amnesty bill for the region's jailed leaders and the thousands of pro-independence supporters who were facing legal action for taking part in Catalonia's independence drive. The bill, which upholds amnesty and the right to self-determination as prerequisites to end the conflict, was backed by lawmakers from the three separatist parties who plan to push it through Spain's Congress next March. Although lawmakers are aware that the bill has no chance of passing the floor of Congress in Madrid, they went on with it. Gerard Artigas, a parliamentary reporter, explains some of the reasons behind their move.
They know the law will not pass because the socialists in Madrid made clear they will not back it. They went on with it nonetheless, thinking that the Spanish Congress might be the right place to raise the debate on amnesty. Besides, they want to bring the bill to Congress in order to force all parties to take a position vis-a-vis amnesty, while at the same time they seek to take advantage of the Congress to sensitize the wider public about the jailed leaders.
Pro-Spanish unity parties in Catalonia's parliament vetoed the bill and dismissed the separatist claim of Spanish state repression in the northeastern region.
To approve the amnesty bill would mean admitting that Spain has been a dictatorship, and nobody buys that. All Western democracies recognize Spain as an equal, with its defects and virtues, but as an equal. Nobody in the international community is going to accept that in Spain there are political prisoners or repression, and therefore there is no room for amnesty.
Over the past 3 years, human rights NGO Amnesty International has repeatedly called on Spain to release two of the nine jailed Catalan leaders who have been sentenced for 9 years for sedition, a crime the NGO described as, quote, vague and against the principle of legality. Cosay Kedri, Barcelona.
The
The situation for childcare in the United States was already perhaps the worst in the Western world. Only Ireland spends less on its children. The average annual price is higher for childcare than for university tuition, and the cost is second only to a family's rent or mortgage. That was before Corona hit. This year, childcare costs have soared nationwide a back-breaking 60%, according to the Center for American Progress, but it has doubled or almost tripled in big cities. Plenty of households weren't prepared for any childcare costs at all, but many free public schools have been shuttered for months due to Corona. The huge price increase has caused parents to quit their jobs just to watch their children and produced financial anxiety for even moderately comfortable households.
Staying home shouldn't be an oath of poverty. You know, if you can afford private child care, great. Let's have public child care that's decent and affordable and facilitates people and protects families, because, you know, child care should be a right.
The federal government's only household relief package this year gave qualified parents just $500 per child. That covers just a few weeks of childcare. It's not just financial. The upending of supervision programs for minors is being called a huge setback in early development and child safety. In cities like Chicago, a minor is 25 times more likely to die from murder than from coronavirus, but closed schools can't provide any structure, and so 2020 has seen a huge increase in juvenile violence and crime.
It's been very stressful on children, and there's been a lot of fallout. I think there's a lot of fallout with a lot of drug therapies being used at younger and younger ages for children. I wonder how that would be if we had better child care and more child care. There's more young people, depression, suicide, and I wonder again how much of this is a result of lack of affordable child care.
Despite the increased cost for parents, the scientific data, and the negative effect on child learning, many in the U.S. want schools to remain closed until autumn 2021. The average parents can only wonder how they'll be able to foot that bill. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
As thousands of people continue to die each and every day in the EU from COVID-19, a great deal of focus is on the issue of vaccines. The subject has just been debated by EU lawmakers.
Le campagne vaccinali sono
Inoculation campaigns began in the UK, the US, Russia and China. The European Union, what was it doing? It's been behind schedule again, waiting for some sort of green light from the European Medicines Agency. Same thing with managing the pandemic. The EU worked very badly. Nations had to go it alone.
We are told that the European Medicines Agency, which authorizes vaccines on behalf of the 27-nation EU, will give the go-ahead next week for use of the Pfizer-BioNTech jab. The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted that vaccination will start across the EU on December 27th, 28th and 29th. However, there is concern that nations are not prepared. Apparently, many EU countries have not yet submitted their vaccination plans to the Commission. EU authorities insist the process cannot be rushed.
Safety of vaccines.
We have been speaking to citizens.
We have to take care of getting this herd immunity through the vaccine. So it is key for our Western states to get there now, given that we're almost in the third wave, I think.
I just think that I will not get the vaccines for myself too early. I just want to wait a little bit to see if there are the secondary effects, bad effects on people.
Lawmakers are expressing outrage that the European Commission is resisting calls to share the formula of proven vaccines with developing nations on the basis that it would stifle investment into vaccine research.
I urge the Commission to rethink their position and to show the world that saving lives is more important than saving an outdated model of intellectual property rights. Access to medicine for all is a human right.
On the economic front, all sides agree that developing a successful vaccine strategy is crucial to preventing the EU from being rendered completely bankrupt. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
House of Kabul is a small but cozy coffee shop in downtown Tehran. As its name suggests,